We were walking unconsciously away from the car, taking steps out of the blast zone. Zach sat in the driver's seat, reaching for us, sobbing.
Please don't go. Don't leave me here.
What can we do? We can try to replace his weight on the seat, Cash panted, looking wildly at the house. It'd have to be at least the same weight as the boy. We don't know how sensitive the switch is. If it's too light, it might... I got it. I ran towards the house. In the hall was a backpack, hanging on a row of hooks cluttered with hats and coats. I grabbed it and sprinted into the living room, almost slipping on the floorboards, and dumped the contents of the bag on the floor. I grabbed anything heavy and started shoving. Wine bottles, a huge dictionary, a cast-iron sculpture on a shelf. Things were crashing everywhere as I went along. My hands were shaking so hard I could hardly use them. Zach's screams burned in my ears. "I'm coming," I screamed. "I'm coming, Zach! Hold on!" Chapter 67. Caitlin's knees buckled beneath her. It was the only thing that saved her from his full arm swing, the punch sailing over her head as fear consumed her completely. She flopped against his legs, defeat turning her limbs to jelly. He grabbed her waist, hair, tried to get hold of her. He was standing too close, stepped back. "Stupid bitch," he snarled. He flipped her, hands beneath her arms, gripping painfully at the tender flesh. "Get back in there." It was the sight of the doorway that awakened the fury again in Caitlin, the enormous sucking weight of the room beyond it, the hours, days, weeks she had lain awake in that concrete nightmare, dreaming of release. Her limbs suddenly hardened. She lifted her leg and slammed it into the doorframe, shocking him, sending them both staggering backwards. "No," she snarled, facing him, her body bent with pain and exhaustion. "Never again." She didn't know how to fight. She'd never so much as been in a loud argument with a stranger. It was raw animal terror taking over now. Her hands sprang into claw shapes, her jaw set and teeth bared. She threw herself at his middle with all her might. They hit the ground hard, his legs coming up and around her waist, arms and hands gripping at her face. She let him pull her into his embrace, bit some part of him hard through his shirt, his shoulder or upper chest. She was blinded, wild, tugging at his face and ears, scratching at his eyes. He rolled and she was suddenly free, stumbling into the walls. She ran as though through water, trying to pull herself along. His footsteps pounded after her. Chapter 68. I ran out the front door of Snail's house, stumbled, caught myself, and rushed to the passenger side door of the four-wheel drive with my arms full of the bag. Snail was standing on the lawn not far away, her face twisted in anguish. Cash stood dazed, his hands by his sides. The bag in my arms was spewing items. I dumped it on the passenger side seat. The kid was wide-eyed, teeth chattering, his legs drawn up and arms gripping the ceiling of the car, shock and terror. "Zach, slide this between your legs. Don't get up until it's on the seat," I stammered. I think it's heavy enough. I remembered seeing a loose house brick by the front door. Zach grabbed the bag. I turned towards the house, stepped back, already twisting, already seeing the brick in my hand, only meters away. I heard the timer scream. Chapter 69. He was behind her, right behind her, his fingers tangled in the very ends of her hair, yanking some of it free. Caitlin ran through the labyrinth of halls, searching for light, seeing only boarded-up windows and locked and barred doors. What floor were they on? What time of day was it? A part of her frantic brain throbbed with denial that any of this was real. She had dreamed so many times of escape. Part of her wanted to stop pushing her body, lie down, give in, wake again to the cellar room where she belonged. Her whole life outside the room had been a dream. She had no mother, no job, no apartment. She'd been born in these dark depths. She needed to stop fighting. The exhaustion was hard to push back as she reached the stairs. a mountain of chipped and splintered wood reaching into more dark space. Just as she leapt forwards, he grabbed her ankle, yanked her down. Her chin hit the bottom stair hard, cracking her teeth. Caitlin grabbed one of the banister rails and it snapped free in her hand. It was light, rotten and damp, but she threw it anyway, causing him to release his hold. She hurled herself up the stairs and turned right, no idea where it might lead. Caitlin's only terror now was running into a dead end. If she was cornered, she knew she would not be able to fight on. Already her knees and hips were aching, threatening to fail. She could hear him breathing, looked back and saw no one there. She tried a door and found it locked. He must be circling around to find her, using another set of stairs. Caitlin screamed for help, banging on doors. The rain was leaking through the ceiling here. She shoved hard against a door and fell into the wet street. The light was blinding. Caitlin crawled towards the blurry, distant road, trying to find the breath to scream. People were there, walking back and forth. Streaks of colour in her ruined vision. She called out, but no one turned. Her voice was gone. She felt a hard hand encircle her arm and yank her backwards. Chapter 70. The street was flooded with people. I was aware first of voices shouting and footsteps hammering the earth nearby. Hands on my body, dragging me, pulling me, lifting my head. I was trapped in a dream, being ravaged by a mob. I opened my mouth and tried to draw air, but my ribs felt flattened. I lay assessing my injuries. I'd hit the back of my head hard. My left radius was broken, and if I didn't get some air soon, I'd be able to add collapsed lungs to my list. I opened my eyes and watched the stars turning around and around against the blackened sky until Cash's face interrupted them. There was a hose in his hand. His big hand was on my head. I realized he was hosing me. I could feel the cold water rushing down my shoulders and over the backs of my arms. My clothes were drenched. "It's only flash burn," he was saying. "Don't worry, you're fine." "Zach," I coughed. I tried to sit up. The four-wheel drive was on fire. People were standing all around it, their mouths open and eyes wide in the dark, watching the flames 4-5 meters high. The roof of the vehicle was twisted backwards like the lid of a tin can. The doors nowhere to be seen. "Don't move." Cash tried to force me down. "You were thrown quite a distance. You could have a spinal injury." "Is he in there?" I asked. Cash didn't answer. "Did the kid make it out?" More voices above me. The grass beneath me felt cool, welcoming, its soft green fingers reaching up over my wrists, dragging me down. I let my head loll to the side, looked at the crowd around the car lit by the flames. Gold masks. At the edge of the gathering nearest to me, I could make out Jace Robert and a slender woman, his wife, in her nightgown. A tall, shaggy friend of Jace's joined him, and then came the other two and their wives. Jace nudged his friend in the ribs and pointed to the car. Stuck out his hands, as though warming his palms, his face cracking with a grin. Chapter 71. "I've got you," the man growled, heaving Caitlin up from the ground, a helpless bundle in his thick arms. "I've got you now, love." Caitlin was so exhausted. Her head fell back against the man's arm, and she looked up at him. Shaggy blonde hair, a hard face with dark, tired eyes. He was running with her, glancing back towards the building as he made for the street. "I've got to get a medic." "Where is he?" she asked. Is he? "I don't know," the man said, "but he's not here, and that's all you need to know. I'm police. You're safe with me. We'll get the prick. Don't you worry about that." "I killed a man," Caitlin whispered. Sleep was pulling at her. There were people all around them now, faces appearing at the man's shoulders as they pushed through. sirens wailing.
What?
I killed someone, Caitlin said.
Yeah?
The blonde man gave a crooked smile. Welcome to the club, sweetheart. Chapter 72. I was in a tiny cubicle lined with pale green curtains, lying stiff as a rod under hot white lights. I jolted as I felt hands around my throat, squeezing, hard fingers against my jaw. I reached up with my good arm and realized it was a plastic neck brace. The pain at the back of my head swelled and I groaned long and low, hoping someone would hear me and bring me drugs. Something was swimming in my system. Probably morphine. My eyes were running tears down my temples. Morphine always makes me cry. I felt for the Velcro strap at the side of my neck. Don't even think about it, Cash's voice. He pulled my hand away. You haven't had your X-ray yet. The television in the corner was playing some game show. A plump, middle-aged woman was jumping up and down in excitement, apparently having chosen well from a selection of gold briefcases being exhibited by tanned models. Zach? He didn't make it, Cash said. I felt a whump of grief in the pit of my stomach, hard as the blow of a fist. Immediately the blame swirled, as it always did, a cacophony of voices roaring between my ears. You should have known he'd steal the gold. You should have listened when he told you he was running away. You should have known Snail's house was a target. You should have saved him. You should have saved him. You should... You were pretty lucky stepping back like that just in time, Cash said. From the corner of my eye, I could see he was watching the television. You've got first-degree burns. They're like a bad sunburn. They'll be gone in a few days. I lifted my left arm and examined the dark blue cast running from the crook of my elbow to my knuckles. My wrist was shattered. I knew the feeling. I'd done it before, taking a swing at someone and hitting a wall instead. Where are we? White Cliffs Hospital, 4 hours out of last chance. Medivac picked us up. Are you okay? Is Vicky? Everyone's fine, he said. Except Zach. I lay sweating in the neck brace, listening to the game show host introducing the rules of the next round. There was $40,000 on the line, a lot of money for some people, enough to give a life for, enough to die for. 3 more days, and I'll be home, Sam. I could last the distance, but not like this. Not lying here, staring at the lights. I pulled off the neck brace. Cash didn't stop me this time. Probably tired of my bullshit. I sat up and felt the stitches in the back of my skull. The bald patch shaved there. What kind of bomb was it? I asked. You shouldn't worry about that right now. Just tell me. It was a circuit breaker, Cash sighed, like I thought. Forensics have a few pieces of it that they're examining. It was a more sophisticated job than the one that killed Theo Campbell, but not by much. There would have been 2 triggers. One was a pop-up hinge, like you see on kitchen cabinet doors, the flashy ones without handles. Instead of pulling the door open, you push it, it clicks, and when you release it, the door pops open. You have to push again and hear the click for the door to close. The killer would have wired the hinge so that when Zach sat down, it clicked and completed the circuit. If he'd have got off the seat, it would have popped open, breaking the circuit, setting off the bomb. Looks like the secondary trigger was a plastic kitchen timer that we heard ticking. You can get them at the supermarket for about $3. The whole thing would have cost little and been easy to source without raising suspicions. Still, let's check with the store in Last Chance in the surrounding towns and see if any kitchen timers have been bought recently and by whom. The results on the IP searches across the valley have come back. No one teaching themselves to make bombs in the last year. We'll need another warrant to go back further. Christ. I rubbed my eyes. Why didn't I think about someone targeting us? The first victim was the chief of police. Of course it makes sense they'd go after Snail next. It mightn't necessarily have been Snail that they were after. Cash shrugged. Maybe it was you or me. Maybe it actually was Zack. I lay back against the pillows and watched my partner watching the TV. His mouth was turned down and his eyes were set. He wasn't his usual self. All the bravado, all the heroic puff had left his voice. He seemed drained. When he spoke, I realized why. I know you spoke to Tenacity, he said. Chapter 73. I said nothing. My job as a sex crimes detective includes working with the utmost discretion at all times. A good majority of the victims I deal with don't want anyone to know what has happened to them, particularly their families. Confirming or denying that I knew Tenacity at all was completely against the rules. Cash seemed to know. Didn't seem to care. He kept talking, turning the wedding ring on his finger around and around. You must have dealt with her after the assault, he said. I know you can't say anything. She thinks I don't know. Her mother told me not long after it happened. Said Tenacity didn't want me to know because she thought I'd probably turn it around, make it a part of my obsession. Well, she was right, of course. I just added it to the hatred I was already feeling. It spurred me on. I'd only just come back from a deployment in Afghanistan and went right back as fast as I could. Stupid. So stupid. He stretched and settled in the seat, his long legs splayed before him. The woman on the television screen was dying of joy. She was up to $75,000. That night in Kuta, in Bali, Cash said, I'd only been out of the bar for about 30 seconds. I walked out to take a phone call from my mum. It was too loud in the bar. I got out the front doors, turned left, and went over to stand on the street corner. I felt the pressure wave thump right through the middle of my body. I was actually knocked off my feet by it. I didn't even hear the bomb blast. I felt like I'd been hit by a car. He ran a hand through his hair. I sat watching, seeing him standing in the corner of the moonlit street, hung with neon lights, people screaming. And then I looked back and the whole place is on fire, he said, and people are running out of it. Some of them are burning. Some of them were missing pieces. I was a surfer. I'd never seen anything like it, not even in the movies. It was like I'd died and suddenly I'd awakened in hell, and I knew right away whoever had caused this, they were from hell. They had to have been, because this wasn't the sort of thing that happened on Earth. The woman on the game show was up to $100,000. A heat rash was creeping up her neck and cheeks. She wiped at her eyes, breathless. Cash watched her. From then on, that's how I saw it, he said. I thought there were evil people, demons, walking around on the earth, plotting to open up the ground and unleash their world on us. I had to fight them, because if I didn't fight them, what was the point of it all? I dropped everything. I went after them. I devoted my life. It was like my wife and my job and my family and my friends had never existed. I had a clear mission with clear enemies, and that was all that mattered. And then last night, he seemed to drift away. I waited. Yesterday I was right back where it all started, feeling the blast, the pressure wave, staring at the flames. It's not... I struggled to find the words. The time hasn't been wasted. You've fought a good fight. There's no way of knowing how many lives you've saved through your work. But I wanted to put a stop to the badness, he said. In my mind, it would have all been over by now. There would be an end, and everything I'd sacrificed would have been worth it. But badness is everywhere. There's a little bit of hell on earth, and you never know when you're going to see it next. Chapter 74. Talk to tenacity, I said. I reached over and grabbed his hand. Call her. We watched as the woman on the screen battled her emotions, trying to decide whether to risk her $100,000 for what was hidden inside the last briefcase. She was pulling on her neck, tugging her ears down, the weight of the decision seeming to physically force her downwards. She picked the mystery briefcase. Animated, sad clown faces flitted and flashed across the screen as a $10 note was revealed, taped to a board on the inside of the case. Cash took out his phone and left me watching the woman crying on the screen. Hell on earth. I'd seen slivers of that place myself. Seen its flames flicker in the eyes of bad men I'd sat across from in the interrogation room, listening to them confess their crimes. I'd seen evil intentions in the eyes of foster fathers who'd welcomed my brother and me into their damp, cluttered homes. Television light glaring on the walls, the blank faces of other abandoned children peering from shadowed corners. I understood the realization Cash had experienced as he stood watching Zach Tabey's body burn in the driver's seat of Snail's car, a decade and a half after he'd watched his friends burn among the remains of dozens of others on a terrible night in Kuta. Sometimes it's easy to get caught up in this job, to think that you're getting on top of evil, that in some wonderful distant future there will be no terrorists, no killers, no rapists and fiends. A dream like that is worth sacrificing everything for. Love, friends, marriage, kids. It seems worth the fight. And then you realize that no matter what you throw in the flames, they keep on burning, mighty and unquenchable. The fight would in fact be eternal. Like Cash, I'd given my life over to the job. I breathed it. I obsessed over it, nurtured it, the way I should perhaps have been nurturing friendships, relationships, maybe children. That sort of stuff hardly occurred to me. And yet it was all other people lived for. Was that what had so strangely drawn me to the baby in Jed Chat's arms? I defied logic, crept close to a man who'd only minutes before held a gun on me, so that I could see a child's eyes. Was something inside me whispering of things I was losing because I refused to believe the world needed to be as bad as it was? Cash had lost his wife because of his commitment to the eternal fight. He needed to get her back. I lay in the hospital bed and held my broken arm against my chest and wondered if I'd be happier if I stopped fighting. I pulled out my IV, pushed aside the blankets, and started untying my hospital gown. Two nurses were standing just outside my cubicle, chatting at the counter. As I tied my shoelaces, they wandered on. I snuck past them and made for the car park. Fighting was all I was good at. I couldn't stop now. Chapter 75. Cash was standing by a police cruiser loaned from Whitecliffs to get us home. He was leaning on the driver's side door, talking gently into the phone. He straightened as he saw me. My partner's here, he told the caller. I gotta go. Love you too. Love you too, huh? I said. Force of habit. He watched me approach. But it's the first time in a long time there were no raised voices. I'm assuming the nurses have not signed your official release. They have not, I said, so let's quit the small talk and get out of here. On the road in the darkness, the cruiser sailed over the ashfield between oceans of featureless desert sand. The sun was just beginning to light the horizon. I looked at my phone. There was a text from my mother telling me she'd got the money I'd transferred. No mention of her disappointment that it was not in cash. A call came through as I was looking at the screen. It was an unfamiliar number. I answered with trembling fingers. "Hello? It's Tox." "Oh," I said. Tox was notoriously difficult to get on the phone, and even harder to converse with once the connection was made. His already poor people skills seemed halved by the distance. My heart sank. "What's happened?" "We found Caitlin McBeal," he said. I reeled, absurdly looking to Cash to see if he'd heard the news. My skin was tingling all over, and not just from the burns. "Is she..." "She's alive." "Jesus!" I sat bolt upright in my seat. "Jesus, what's she saying?" "Don't get excited. She's not saying much at all, and what she is saying doesn't sound good for you. She says a guy's been keeping her in a cellar for the last few months, practically starving her to death. She thinks he's connected to Sam. A partner, maybe."
"What do you mean, she thinks that?"
"I mean, that's what she thinks."
"Christ, Tox, explain what you mean."
I tried not to yell. Every fibre of my being was telling me to scream.
"What exactly did she say?"
"She says he didn't touch her the whole time," he grumbled. "Didn't rape her, didn't torture her, hardly looked at her. Just seemed to go on standby mode, almost like he didn't know what to do with her. Caitlin thinks it's because Sam was arrested. She thinks they were a double act, and once Sam was gone, the guy who kept her lost interest." I shivered in my seat. The drugs were still in my system, making my mind fragmented, twitchy. Again, I felt that magnetic pull towards my home. I needed to get back there, speak to Caitlin, convince her that she was wrong. 3 days. I'd go to her hospital room, look her in the eyes.
"I
haven't got time to relate it all to you play by play," Tox said. "We're standing outside Caitlin's hospital room waiting to go in. Detective Nigel Fuckface is giving us 15 minutes with her."
"Who's the guy?"
I gripped the phone tight. "The guy who abducted Caitlin. Did you catch him?"
"No, he slipped away," Tox said. "You'll see the sketch on the news in a couple of hours, I reckon."
"But..." The line went dead.
"Fuck!"
I screamed long and loud, looking at the phone screen, Tox's number, and the call ended message. He'd hung up on me.
Fuck! Fuck!
Chapter 76. Whit and Tox stood side by side, leaning against the wall outside Caitlin McBeal's hospital room. A few metres down the hall from them, a group of detectives lingered, people from sex crimes and major crimes, some trauma-trained officers Whit recognised from the Parramatta headquarters. Beyond them at the nurse's station, a group of journalists had already assembled, arguing with 3 beat cops who held them back from the hall. A photograph of Caitlin McBeal in her current state would have been worth a lot of money, Whit thought. It was guaranteed front-page news. Over the 4 and a bit months she had been held captive, Caitlin had lost a good 10 kilos, and her hair had thinned by half. The girl Tox had carried to the ambulance outside the abandoned Pinkerton Hotel had looked like a cancer patient. Sunken eyes and yellowed teeth, her neck and arms covered in bed sores. Her lips had been dry and cracked and bleeding. Tox had described finding her in the alley outside the hotel, desperately trying to crawl towards the street, the exertion of escaping her captor having reduced her almost to unconsciousness. The doctors were saying that had the unfortunate homeless man, Ronnie Hipwell, not stumbled upon her makeshift prison cell and initiated her escape, she would have been mere days from death. It was both a miracle and a tragedy that Hipwell had ventured down to the lower basement level after rain flooding the ground floor had pushed aside the trash that had been obscuring the door leading downstairs. Caitlin was free. Hipwell was dead. Detective Nigel Spader emerged from the room and closed the door behind him, eyeing Tok suspiciously as he tucked his notebook into his back pocket. 5 more minutes, he said.
You said that an hour ago, Tok said.
Yeah, maybe I did. What are you going to do about it?
I'm going to go in there.
Tok stepped forwards, pointed at the door behind his fellow officer, and if you try to stop me, you'll find yourselves downstairs in triage.
You're lucky you're getting access to the witness at all, Barnes, Nigel spat. You are not on this task force. Neither of you are. And I can deny an interview any time I want.
It was the first time Whit had seen Tok almost lose his cool.
Let me tell you a few things, Tok said, jerking a thumb at Whit. This two-man investigation right here. We've got enough to get a mistrial and a bail in the very least.
Bullshit. We've traced the camera from Sam Blue's apartment to a hock shop in Bondi. Tok started listing on his fingers. And we've got a video of a man purchasing the camera, who digital imaging analysts say is far too tall to be Blue. You yourselves admitted that your people muscled Blue to extract the confession. We found Caitlin McBeal's mobile phone at the crime scene you guys released. Your 10-man crack team of task force cockheads is going to look really stupid when the press gets wind of this. You need to fuck off and do some damage control and leave Caitlin McBeal to us.
The bigger man had all but backed Nigel into the wall.
Nigel shoved Tox's chest.
Back the fuck up, murderer.
There's no need to be so hostile. Whit came between the two men. We're cooperating with you, Detective Spader. We let you know as soon as we had a lead on Caitlin's possible whereabouts so that your officers could be on the scene if she was found. That was a goodwill gesture. Now return the favour. And let us have our time with Caitlin.
I don't know how good multiple interviews are for her right now, Nigel mused, his eyes never leaving Tox. She's very fragile.
You know what else is fragile? Tox said. Your neck.
Tox and the much shorter detective stared at each other. The door to Caitlin's room opened, and another officer walked out.
Whit took the opportunity to slip through the gap as the door closed.
Chapter 77. The room was full of people. Caitlin lay against the pillows, talking softly to a police e-fit specialist who sat beside her, scrolling through selections of eyebrows for the composite image of Caitlin's captor. In the chair on the other side of the bed, Caitlin's mother sat quietly crying, talking on her phone. Whit understood Mrs. McBeal had arrived a week earlier to put extra pressure on the investigative team.
I can't believe it either, she was saying. No, I just can't believe it. I tried to tell them. I tried to tell them all along.
Caitlin, I'm Detective Inspector Edward Whittaker, he said, shifting awkwardly between two men standing in the doorway. Detectives or counsellors, family members, Whit didn't know. I'm part of the team who found you.
You're Detective Barnes' partner?
Caitlin looked at him with tired eyes.
Yes. Come here.
She patted the bed beside her. Whit moved around the bed, squeezing between people, and settled on the edge beside the girl. Her strength was incredible. As Whit looked about the room, he noticed more than half the people here were crying. Though Caitlin looked exhausted, a tiny fire seemed to be burning in her, brightening her eyes. She was being strong for the people here. Her family and friends and those who had been searching for her. They needed to know she was all right.
I know you've answered a lot of questions already, Whit said, but I just need to know anything you can tell me about your captor's connection with Sam Blue. Did the man who kept you ever say anything about Sam? Did he ever say his name?
He was very shocked and angry at his arrest, Caitlin said. We watched it on the television in the room together that first night. He said they weren't finished yet. They weren't finished yet? Whit swallowed. His mouth was bone dry. Are you sure those were his exact words? Caitlin reached over and held Whit's hand. Her fingers were cool and hard, rough from long months in the concrete cell, slowly dying in the darkness. He said he needed him. See, he didn't touch me, Caitlin said, not once. He didn't even speak to me. He was just holding me. He didn't know what to do. His partner, Sam, was gone, and he didn't know what to do without him. Whit tried to breathe. His throat was tight. I saw Sam Blue a lot while I was locked up, Caitlin said. The TV was my only company. I'd see him walking to court, see footage of him giving evidence. I looked at his eyes. There was a deadness there. It was the same deadness that I saw in the eyes of the man who held me. It was like something inside him had shriveled up and there was only emptiness left. Whit felt a chill come over him. They killed those girls, Detective, Caitlin said. That man and Sam Blue, they're the same kind of monster. Chapter 78. The smoking husk of Snail's four-wheel drive had been screened off from the public eye by white tent. I saw the flashes of the forensic officer's cameras as we pulled into the driveway, their ghoulish silhouettes augmented by protective suits. All the front windows of Snail's house had blown out. Glass crunched under my feet as I made my way up the drive. Again, the townspeople drove by slowly, pressing their faces against their car windows. Others gathered in huddles at a safe distance some meters down the road to gawk and mutter, some still in their bedclothes. There was a mustachioed officer talking to Snail as I walked into the house. The guy gave me an odd look as I entered. Snail turned away from him and threw her arms around me. "Oh, Harry," she squeezed me painfully, smoothed down the sides of my hair. I could see she'd been crying. She examined me all over, the cast, my face, the torn remnants of the clothes I'd worn during the blast, still reeking of smoke. "I can't believe you're here. They released you already?" "The bomb," I said, ignoring her mothering and turning to the forensics officer. "Any traces? Anything we can use?" "Nothing biological," he said. "Everything burned to a crisp. Hot and fast, those gas bottle jobs. Our main concern now is recovering everything we can of the boy for the parents." My stomach twisted. I must have made a face because Snail reached up and continued patting my hair. "Did you speak to them, Zach's parents?" I asked her. "What did they say? Are they okay? We should get them into counseling. On suicide watch, maybe. They'll be fragile. They might..." "Just give it a break for a while, Harriet," she said. "You look like the walking dead. You smell even worse. Have 15 minutes off, and then we can get back to it." Chapter 79. I walked numbly to the bathroom and stripped, pulling off a bunch of soft layers of skin from my forearms and neck. Looking in the mirror, half my face appeared badly sunburned, already peeling at my temple. I must have turned away at the last second, put my hands up to try to shield myself from the blast. The tender flesh on the underside of my forearms had taken the worst hit. The edges of my cast rubbed the irritated skin, causing it to burn anew. I held my arm up out of the stream of cool water and closed my eyes, raked back my singed hair. Against the back of my eyelids, I could see the outline of Zach's mangled corpse in the front seat. the flames twisting around him, flaring out over the roof. I screamed as something brushed against my leg. The pig had muscled his way into the bathroom and nosed open the shower door. "Vicky! Vicky, help! Oh, God!" I hollered, trying to shove the beast away. It weighed half a ton. Snail rushed into the room, horrified, trying to shield her eyes from my naked form. "Oh, God, I'm sorry." Despite everything, we were both almost laughing. "He likes to drink the water. I think it's the soap. It tastes different. Oh, Jesus, I'm so sorry. Jerry! Jerry! Come here, you idiot!" The pig was snorting and snuffling at the few centimetres of water at the bottom of the shower. Eventually, Snail gave up trying to haul the animal out of the shower with me. I got out, and she handed me a towel. "I'm seeing stuff on the news about Sam," she said. "The girl they found, Caitlin? Someone got some footage of her being carried to an ambulance. She looked terrible." "Nothing about us out here?" I asked. "The bombing? Zach?" "No, no way. We're small fry." She sat on the toilet seat near me. I wrapped the towel around my body, felt exhausted. "The girl," Snail cleared her throat. "She's saying..." "I know what she's saying," I said. "It isn't true." Snail shifted uncomfortably. "Would anything make you believe that it was?" she asked. I took a comb from the edge of the sink and pulled it through my hair, looking at my own eyes in the mirror. Sam's eyes. "No," I answered. Chapter 80. Cash was in the living room, looking at the diary, the book pressed flat on the tabletop in front of him. On the left-hand page was a sketch of a body fitted out for a massacre, a faceless dummy strapped with guns and knives. It was a lot like the sketches Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris had made in their own diaries as they planned their assault. They'd envisioned body harnesses in which they could house handheld pipe bombs, holsters with easy access to knives for hand-to-hand combat should they run out of ammo. The diarist had copied excerpts from Eric's diary into their own. I must not be sidetracked by my feelings of sympathy, mercy. I want to burn the world. In reality, the boys had become bored midway through their killing spree and hadn't used most of the weaponry they'd strapped themselves. It was the same with Sung-hee Cho, the Virginia Tech killer. He seemed to burn out his rage much faster than he went through his ammunition. It was all about build-up with these guys, anticipation of the terror of their victims. Maybe that was why the killer had left the note for Zach on the steering wheel, warning him that he was going to die. Otherwise, why not just let the thing activate itself the moment he shifted position? Why give him a chance? Why give him time to escape? So he could think about it. So he could know death was coming and be afraid. "Yow!" Cash yelped, drew a finger to his lips. "What?" "Ah, scraped it on the staple." He sucked blood from the tiny cut, examined the injury in the light. I went to the book, sat down next to him. Indeed, there were two staples in the centre of the notebook, holding the pages in place. The bottom fold of one staple was crooked, sticking up slightly, a trap that would catch a careless hand sweeping over it. I pushed the fold of the staple down. It sprang back up. Something rushed over me. An electric sensation that made all my injuries come alive at once, my muscles hardening. I snatched the book up and examined it in the light of the living room, tilted it to get the right angle. "Oh my God," I whispered. "There's a page missing." Chapter 81. "How do you know that?" Snail took the diary from me, examined it, squinting. "The staples are crooked. Someone's bent them outwards to slide the middle page out of the notebook without tearing the paper. They've folded the staples back, but they're not completely flat. I took the book from her hands. Look, here. I can see the shape of a square indented in the next page. It isn't on the previous page. The missing page has left indentations. Snail shifted away, her face taut with concentration. She began pulling open drawers and shuffling through them. She found a pencil and a blank sheet of paper and came back to the dining room table. She flattened the book and began gently shading the pages with the side of the pencil. "Shouldn't we wait for forensics?" Cash asked. "Get a carbon scan?" "We don't have time," I said. "It could easily tell us what's happening next. There was a reason it was removed so carefully." My heart was hammering. Watching Snail shading every millimetre of the paper was painful. She experimented, shading lighter and harder, trying to find the best pressure to reveal the pattern underneath. Lines, squares, arrows pointing, and labels. A map was emerging before us. Two rows of blocks, some longer, some short, the same distance apart as they were wide. "It's the main street," I said. "It's Last Chance Valley." Chapter 82. Whit slammed the piece of paper against the prison plexiglass and pointed at it. "Who the fuck is this?" He wasn't usually the type to curse, but his resolve had worn thin. Sitting with Caitlin McBeal in a room full of people who had all but given up on the idea of ever seeing her again had pushed him over the edge. Whit's instinct was to bundle her up, feed her, care for her like a newborn babe. Sam examined the paper Whit was holding against the glass of the visitor's centre, the e-fit image of the man who had almost killed Caitlin. Sam glanced at Whit, shrugged. "I have no idea." "Enough bullshit." Whit leaned forward so that his nose was centimetres from the glass. "This is the guy. We've got him on CCTV purchasing the camera that was found in your apartment." He shuffled through his papers and extracted the image from the hawk shop. "We've got Caitlin saying he was desperately upset at your arrest. He's around your age. Slim, long arms. This guy could be your twin. Who the fuck is he?" "I don't know," Sam pleaded. "I've been watching it all morning on the news. I'm telling you, I don't know the guy. I've never seen him before in my life." Whit let the paper slide from the glass, slumped back in his chair. "I don't believe you," he sighed. "I can't anymore. It's not as though he would tell her you were partners for the benefit of framing you. He didn't expect her to survive." "He told her we were partners?" "In a roundabout way." Sam scratched at his neck, then shook his head violently, like he was trying to clear water from his ears. "How did she survive?" Sam asked. "She got away." "Maybe he planned that." "I doubt it. She killed a homeless man. She fought for her life to get out of that place. When Tox found her, she was crawling on the ground. The experts reckon she had mere days left." "Look." Sam shifted closer to the glass. "I need you to keep believing in me or I'll never get out of here." "If you want to get out of here, you better keep looking at this damn picture and figure out who the hell he is." Whit left the image resting face up on the counter. He said nothing as he headed past the security guards and into the hall. Whit hated to admit it, but he was beginning to wonder if Sam Blue was exactly where he belonged. Chapter 83. It was a massacre plan. As the missing page emerged, my heart sank lower and lower. Before, when the diary had been mainly praise for spree killers, research into bombs and weaponry, I could underestimate the diarist's plans for the people of Last Chance Valley. But I could see now this killer planned to make sure no one survived. The buildings of the main street made two identical columns down the center of the page. On the right, the post office, a hardware store, a tiny cafe, and a supermarket, among others. On the left, across the street from the post office, lay Snail's tiny police station, a single-story square with a single interrogation room, a single cell, desk space for two, and the armory. Next came the pub with its rear car park, a farming supply store, and a mechanics, also with a wide asphalt parking lot. Four main buildings, shoulder to shoulder, forming two identical blocks. Around the buildings, the diarist had marked a dotted line, the path of his plan. Step one, kill Officer Snail in police station, acquire weapons. Step two, plant device number one in the car park behind pub, set timer. Step three, take the semi-trailer from the mechanic car park and use it to block off bottom of the main street, creating a U-shape to trap victims. Step five, plant devices number two and number three in semi-trailer, set timers. Step four, get John Destro and secure upper balcony of the post office. Cash, Snail, and I looked over the faint map, following the steps. This is terrifying, Snail murmured, a thin sheen of sweat glistening at her hairline. You're the tactics guy, I told Cash. What do you think? A brief smile flashed over his features, a truce between us, his mass casualty expertise finally coming into play. It's a single-man operation, he said. All the steps are sequential. There's nothing here to indicate that there are two people acting simultaneously. Whoever he is, he's pretty confident. Step one, taking out you, Vicky, as you man the police station, that's no mean feat. I don't imagine he's just going to waltz in there and you're going to hand him the keys to the armory. Unless he's already got a gun, Snail said, and he's just going to surprise me and upgrade from whatever he has to one of the semi-automatics. There was a moment of tense silence. Cash put a finger on the paper and traced the dotted line. He then goes and plants what I can only imagine is one of his bombs in the car park behind the pub. He takes a semi-trailer and uses that to block off the street, effectively making a trap. His first bomb must be to drive everyone out of the pub into the street. The truck explodes, blocking off an escape that way. Everyone is herded into this space. He pointed to the center of the map, the U-shape made by the buildings and the burning truck. They're rounded up like cattle. The road up past the post office is the only way out, and from the balcony with a semi-automatic, he's ready to pick them off one by one as they run for their lives. Snail was lost for words. She pursed her lips. It's very sophisticated. Cash finished for her, looking over the page. It uses crowd-herding tactics to maximize the death toll. He'd have learned that from the spree killers he studied. Anticipate where the victims will cluster naturally, predict their movements when they panic, and channel them into the line of fire by securing the exits. It's interesting, though, that he doesn't channel the survivors of the initial blast into a final explosion. He wants to shoot them down one at a time. It's the same reason he left the note on the steering wheel, I said. The same reason he was pacing at the side of Theo Campbell's death. He wants to give them time to think about what's happening to them, time to... I shrugged. I don't know. To feel... Sorry, Cash said. Sorry for what? Snail said. I flipped through the diary. The only thing I could think that united all the spree killers in the diary was their rage, their desire to be punishers. I didn't want to die, but I would have no choice. Vengeance is the only path. I will get you all back. You could have stopped this. You were right, Harry, Cash said. You were right from the start. It's not terrorism. He's not trying to make a political statement, to get people to act. This is pure vengeance. He wants the people of Last Chance Valley to feel sorry for whatever it is they've done to cause this. What have we done? Snail asked. There were tears in her eyes now. She sighed helplessly. I watched her leave the table for the bathroom, swiping at her cheeks. I turned back to the map. The plan really seems to be all about maximizing casualties, I said. So we can assume it'll go off when the most people possible are at the local pub, if the killer hasn't abandoned his plan. I don't see why he would have, Cash said. He knows we have the diary, but he doesn't know we have the plan page. He has no reason to suspect that the plan has been compromised. So when are most people down at the pub? Most of the town is there every Saturday night, Snail said from the doorway. We all looked at the calendar on the wall. We had 2 days to stop a massacre. Chapter 84. We called Des and asked him to get the word out that people weren't to congregate in the town. Snail left us for Zach Tabey's parents' house with a pair of counsellors who had flown in from Whitecliffs. I sat in the passenger seat of Cash's car and deleted all the many text messages from journalists on my phone, some about Last Chance Valley's deaths, more about Sam. I looked up the eFit image of the man Caitlin McBeal was telling the world was my brother's accomplice. I didn't know him. I wanted so desperately to feel some spark of recognition. I ran my eyes over his long, straight nose and dark eyes, over the shape of his shaved head. Like most eFit images, I knew this would be a cleaner, slightly dimmed version of the real man. But there was no trigger in my brain, not even the softest soundings of alarm. I looked at the time. In 4 minutes, Sam would have access to the prison phones. Cash was walking towards the car. I had my finger poised over the answer button. My brother's going to call me in a minute. Oh, do you want... No, it's fine. Let's get rolling. The phone rang. Cash shifted uncomfortably in his seat as he started the car. Hi, Sammy, I said. This is a reverse charge call from Silverwater Metropolitan Remand and Reception Centre, a division of Silverwater Correctional Complex. If you wish to accept the call, press 1. Oh, I always forget about the automated message, I sighed. Cash gave an awkward smile. Harry? It was Sam. Hi. I could feel myself smiling, despite the heaviness in my heart. Are you okay? I'm a bit numb, to be honest, he said. When they said they had a picture of the guy, I was so ready for it to be someone I knew. I mean, it'd have to be, right? I was ready to be in an absolute rage, but this guy, I don't know him, do you? No, I said. Never seen him before in my life. This is unbelievable. Sam sounded scared. I sounded scared too. My voice was coming back to me, half a second later. The recording device used by the prison echoing as it taped us. Maybe if they catch him, it can all come to an end. Wit and Tox are on it, I said. I'm going to wrap up here, and then I'll be right there with them. I'd rather you weren't, he said. Harry, he got into my apartment. He can get into yours. What he did to those women, he's an animal. He's smart and he's vicious. I'm pretty vicious myself, you know. Cash smiled beside me as he drove. I know you are, but I just don't need anything else to worry about. If I know you're out there in the desert, I can at least pretend you're safe. Sam was always like that when we were kids, protective, worrisome. When we were placed in different homes, he would sometimes run away from his placement to find me, even if he had to catch the train from one side of the state to the other, just to see me in person with his own eyes and confirm I was all right. I felt a powerful yearning to be home with him, to be on the hunt for the man in the picture. I told Sam we were going to catch this guy. one way or another. I'd spend every dollar I had. I would give up my job, my life, my freedom.